Now, shall we begin?
Religion is a very private affair, but we have a diverse society with many, many faiths, and every faith has to respect each other. Faith should not be used as a knife to discriminate, and that's what these people are doing, using their so-called religion to discriminate against people.
We are entitled to our personal lifestyles, but forcing them on those with no power to refuse troubles me, wrote George Takei on June 28th on his Facebook page, referring to a blog post that bore the following title: Vegan Gets Absolutely Destroyed on Tumblr After Giving Their Dog a Meatless Diet. Mr. Takei, since he's no longer playing the character of Hikaru Sulu in the Star Trek franchise, has emerged as something of a self-appointed human rights monitor. And he espouses simultaneously two mutually contradictory views. Government, particularly the federal government, is a murderous and oppressive enterprise that kills and expropriates people without cause. And the second is that that same murderous enterprise can somehow use that function to bring about social justice by threatening to kill and expropriate people who claim their right to refuse, their right to say no. Mr. Takei apparently sees it as an ethical necessity to protect the power of an individual to refuse, at least where non-human species are concerned, the right to withhold consent to say no and to have that no respected, is perhaps the most elemental form of property rights, which is one of the things that distinguish us from the other orders of creation. Mr. Takei, like others of his ideological ilk, will recognize that principle for some human beings. For instance, I have no doubt whatsoever that Mr. Takei, who was wrongfully imprisoned and his family expropriated by the federal government during World War II, would recognize that this was a violation of their right to refuse to dispose of what they had earned and what they had built, not because of anything they had done. I don't doubt for a second that he would understand the consummate injustice involved in that denial of their right to refuse. We don't want to go to a relocation camp. You don't have the right to refuse. However, he doesn't apply that same principle for people who are not among the favored tribes from the perspective of those who are presiding over our cultural revolution. There's been a lot of soul-searching lately about the myriad religious freedom, or RFRA, laws that have been popping up around the country in places like Arizona, Mississippi, Michigan, Georgia, Arkansas, and most famously Indiana, wrote Mr. Takei in an April 2nd, 2015 column for the Daily Beast. Much of the brouhaha began when a bakery way out in Oregon, acting on the religious beliefs of its owner, refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. Thus were born the great cake debates. Of course, the issue runs much deeper than that. Indeed, it does. The cake is really just that, a cake. But if you believe the rhetoric of the right, we gay people are trying to have our marriages and eat our cakes, too. The individualist view, I interject at this point, is that people of any description are free to eat any cake they make themselves or buy from a willing seller, but that compelling someone to provide a service is morally impermissible and constitutionally unsupportable, given the 13th Amendment's prohibition of involuntary servitude. A slave cannot say no. A slave cannot withhold his services. To continue, supporters of the RFRA laws commonly point out that a federal version of the law has been on the books for a long time, since 1993, in fact, and was signed by President Clinton. They argue that there could be nothing wrong with further protecting the First Amendment rights of citizens to believe what they want to believe, to associate with whom they want to associate, and to bake for whomever they want to bake. By the way, it's a property right. Not merely a right of conscience, it's a property right that inheres in everybody, irrespective of their religious beliefs, if any, or their non-religious beliefs. To continue, critics of such laws, meaning the religious freedom laws, and I am one of them, continues Takei, counter that states are resurrecting them in a cynical response to marriage equality decisions coming out of federal courts, that may be true, it is completely inconsequential in a logical sense if one understands the primacy of property rights. These laws were originally enacted to protect certain Indian tribal rights from government intrusion. They were never intended to extend the personal rights of citizens so far as to potentially impinge upon the public accommodation rights of others. There is no such thing as a right to a public accommodation. You cannot assert a property right in something that belongs to another. There is a right to be free from force or fraud. If you can prove that you were defrauded somehow by a business owner, that becomes a matter of which some government, preferably one that does not constitute a monopoly on the use of force, can take action to demand some form of redress. But the locution public accommodation essentially is an assertion that everything that takes place within a society is subject to political regulation by the state, that nothing is beyond the state's influence and beyond its regulatory scrutiny. Thus twisted, continues Decay, the RFRA transforms into a license to discriminate against LGBT persons. That is why context, the reason the laws were drafted today, matters a great deal and why so many stand opposed to their enactment. The context is one of who does what to whom. It's perfectly all right to set aside an area in which people who belong to a recognized, specially protected class, such as Native American Indians, can pursue their religious freedom. But when that principle is used to try to protect the property rights of people who've done no harm to others, but the people who are being focused upon in this example hold beliefs that are not a courant, that are not embraced by the self-appointed paladins of tolerance, then suddenly what is really important is to contextualize the law in a way that will accommodate the prejudices of the so-called progressives. So then, what is really going on beneath the politics and the legal maneuvering? Why would a state like Indiana want to arm its citizens with the power to discriminate, to refuse to make that cake? The power to discriminate is what? It's the right to refuse. In his hierarchy of moral concerns, a Christian business owner has less liberty, has less of a claim to property rights than a dog. And why does that notion sit so badly with so many that we are out calling for boycotts of an entire state? In an entirely predictable and thoroughly wrong-headed fashion, Mr. Takei says that people who do not want to be compelled by law to provide services that violate their religious conscience are standing on the same side of history with people who were promoting government-imposed discriminatory laws in the pre-civil rights South, which of course is not true. Nobody who's defending the rights of bakers or florists or wedding photographers to decline to offer services, or more recently pharmacists in the state of Washington who do not want to provide abortifacient drugs that are readily available within a mile or so of the privately owned pharmacies that they operate. These people are not seeking the state's role in imposing anything on anybody. They are seeking to be protected from the coercive power of the state. That in this instance, Mr. Takei sees as serving a redemptive function. Today, proponents of the RFRA want to send a similar message to that, supposedly, of the Jim Crow-era discriminatory South. Federal law may say your marriages are equal, but the good, pious people of this state think otherwise, and so we should not have to bend so much as a finger for you. Especially in small towns across the country, that message sometimes translates into one of open hostility. Go ahead and have your gay marriage. You may not find anyone here willing to help you with it. So far, we've not seen that that's a problem. In every one of the high-profile marquee cases involving so-called discrimination against gay couples, the couples have readily found business owners who are more than willing to sell them cakes or floral arrangements or to provide photography services. It's entirely a question of belief for him as to whether or not you have the right to refuse. He continues that the contemporary RFRA laws are truly sore loser laws designed to make as hollow as possible the fruits of marriage equality, that the state would sanction this type of law, which effectively gives shopkeepers and proprietors the right to turn out the gays. Once again, the right that he recognizes that a dog should have to refuse feeds into a general unwelcoming atmosphere where LGBTs cannot feel accepted or at peace, precisely because they never know when or from whom the next indignity will come. Anybody who is constantly possessed of a hypersensitivity toward perceived indignities will find no shortage of them. adults learn to deal with indignities without imposing through violence upon the property rights of others. Once again, Mr. Takei understands that principle when it applies to a dog. He does not apply that to human beings whose views he doesn't like. And this, of course, is made all the more ironic by the fact of what happened to him. I'll have a lot more to say about this when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Stand by for more sedition after this.
You'll change. I mean, can you see? You're a man I know. He has this incredible library, Rick Warren. Literally one of the great libraries I've ever seen in my life, kept beautifully. You have all these books by all these great scholars. Many, many of them will have evolved their thought processes over things, depending on how they see things. Can you see a time when not just you, but other Christian preachers, and indeed the Catholic Church and others, say, you know what, actually real equality means? Everyone has the same right to get married, gay or straight.
It was, I believe, the late Joseph Sobran who said that the collectivist left defines religion as a private matter and then uses the state effectively to abolish privacy. This is a pretty good example of what the late and very much missed Mr. Sobran probably had in mind. At the website of the Securities and Exchange Commission, we can find the following notice. California UNRRA Act litigation, Werner et al. Versus Spark Networks Incorporated and Spark Networks USA Limited Liability Corporation and Wright et al. Versus Spark Networks Incorporated and Spark Networks USA LLC et al. On July 19, 2013, Aaron Werner, on behalf of himself and all other similarly situated individuals, this was to be a class action lawsuit, filed a putative class action complaint, the Werner complaint, in the Superior Court of the State of California, County of Los Angeles, against Spark Networks and Spark Networks USA. The Werner complaint alleges that Spark Networks website ChristianMingle.com violates California's UNRRA Civil Rights Act, or the UNRRA Act, by allegedly discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. The Werner complaint requests the following relief: an injunction, statutory, general, compensatory, treble, and punitive damages, attorney's fees and costs, pre-judgment interest, and an award for any other relief the court deems just and appropriate. On December 23, 2013, Richard Wright, on behalf of himself and all other similarly situated individuals, filed a putative class action complaint, the Wright complaint, in the Superior Court for the State of California, County of San Francisco, against Spark Networks Incorporated. The Wright complaint alleges that Spark Networks Incorporated's commercial dating services, including ChristianMingle.com, LDSSingles.com, CatholicMingle.com, BlackSingles.com, MilitarySinglesConnection.com, and AdventistSinglesConnection.com violate the UNRRA Act by allegedly intentionally and arbitrarily discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. The Wright complaint requests the following relief: a declaratory judgment, a preliminary and permanent injunction, statutory penalties, reasonable attorney's fees and costs, prejudgment interest, and an award for any other relief the court deems just and appropriate. Spark Networks filed a motion to coordinate the two matters in Los Angeles Superior Court, and the motion was granted. The parties are currently awaiting an order designating the coordinated case judge and the coordinated cases and stayed pending such action. That action occurred just a couple of days ago. A judgment was handed down by the Superior Court in Los Angeles that contained the following order. By the way, I find it interesting that this document was apparently drafted by the attorneys for the plaintiffs, because it reads proposed judgment with the word proposed crossed out, which means that the judge who signed this document merely amended it by crossing out proposed. He took the draft that was presented to him and he simply ratified it. He did not exercise discretion or judgment in any sense. He simply ratified the document that was placed on his desk. For a period of 2 years from the date this judgment is entered by the court, Spark will ensure that the man-seeking woman and woman-seeking man options on the Gateway home pages of the Mingle sites only ask whether the user is a man or a woman. Consider this for a second. There's nothing discriminatory about allowing people to self-select a dating service. There are dating services of all types and varieties, I would assume. I've never used them. I've never looked at them. I'm making a discriminatory judgment by avoiding those sites. But this is not something of general application. The problem is not that these people have a monopoly on online dating opportunities. The problem is that they are daring to reserve to themselves spaces that define dating according to the moral perceptions and moral teachings of various religious communities. Supposedly, it is discriminatory for a Christian dating site to expect that people who use it will subscribe to the Christian definition of marriage in whatever denominational setting. To continue, Spark will not change the Gateway homepages to use the man-seeking woman and woman-seeking man prompts in the future unless Spark also provides similar prompts which allow individuals seeking a same-sex match to enter and use the sites without having to state that they are seeking a match with someone of the opposite sex. As long as Spark operates the Mingle sites, users will continue to have the ability to search for potential same-sex matches using the site's text searching and profile building functions. In other words, they're changing the conditions of association in these private dating websites. These privately owned and privately operated businesses will now be forced to change the terms of their association to accommodate people who probably are not interested in using them, but simply cannot abide the idea that somewhere somebody sees the world differently than they do. Spark represents and warrants that it is updating the Mingle sites, and to the extent Spark continues to operate any of the Mingle sites in the future, such sites will be updated to create an experience which will allow individuals seeking same-sex partners to use Spark's matching technologies to find and be matched with others seeking same-sex partners. That is involuntary servitude. That is not the way that these businesses were originally constructed. They're being forcibly redefined through the threat of legislation that is enforced through the power of government coercion. For all Spark sites that remain operational, Sparks will update them within 24 months of the date of this judgment. If, for non-discriminatory reasons, Spark does not meet this timetable, Spark will notify plaintiff's counsel of the same no later than 30 days following the deadline. Spark represents and warrants that it operates the mobile application CrossPaths, which facilitates faith-based same-sex matching, and that Spark will continue to operate CrossPaths and provide same or similar same-sex matching until at least December 31st, 2016. What that means is that they already had a site set aside for people who profess to be Christians who are pursuing same-sex relationships. They already provided that function, that service. What's happening now is that the other ones are being forcibly reconfigured. Spark will pay $9,000 each to class representatives Aaron Werner and Richard Wright as a service award for their efforts on behalf of the settlement class and release of their damage claims. Spark will pay $450,000 in attorney's fees and costs to class counsel. So they're supposedly paying these extortionists who filed this spurious lawsuit for the services they supposedly rendered, and being forced to cough up $500,000 to the collectivist ambulance chasers who facilitated this judgment that was signed by, I believe the name is Anna Jones. It was originally assigned to Judge Jane L. Johnson. That name was crossed out, and an almost illegible notation was made to the judge who actually signed this order which was no doubt written by plaintiff's attorneys. This is precisely what it means to say that religion is a private affair, and then to see the government effectively abolish privacy. I'll be back in just a minute. There is a purely civil profession of faith of which the sovereign should fix the articles, wrote Jean-Jacques Rousseau. While the state can compel no one to believe them, it can banish from the state anyone who does not believe them. The subjects owe the sovereign an account of their opinions, only to such an extent as they matter to the community. Once again, I'm reminded of Sobrin's prediction that religious freedom would be defined as something that is private and that the state would abolish privacy. Whoever dares to say outside the church there is no salvation ought to be driven from the state unless the state is the church and the prince is the pontiff, continued Rousseau. If anyone, after publicly recognizing these dogmas, behaves as if he does not believe them, let him be punished by death. He has committed the worst of all crimes, that of lying before the law, concluded Jean-Jacques Rousseau in Book 4 of his work, The Social Contract, in putting flesh on the concept of the civil religion, a phrase, I believe, that was of Rousseau's coinage. The purpose of this doctrine was to enable the masses to bear with docility the yoke of the public good. I want to underscore the fact that the most important article of that civil religion, as defined by Rousseau and as implemented by the feeders of the guillotine during the French Revolutionary Reign of Terror, was the absolute divinity of the state, and the gravest transgression was intolerance, which was regarded as an evil not because it injured the rights of individuals, but because it challenged the state's authority. This is why, as Rousseau put it, the ideal social arrangement would be, quote, a form of theocracy. And under that theocracy, one would be compelled to profess belief, whether or not that person actually believed in the tenets being prescribed by the state. The state could compel people to profess belief in them and then use that profession as a standard to judge the behavior of the involuntary adherent to the official dogma. And if your behavior deviated from your profession, you were to be executed. And once again, that's the doctrine that cultivated the forest of guillotines that sprung up once Rousseau's teachings had taken root. The contemporary gender revolution is a Jacobinical movement. It began, as such affairs always do, by promising individual emancipation, and it has now entered the early phases of what promises to be an administrative reign of terror in which heretics against the new civil religion are pursued and subjected to exemplary punishment for the purpose of vindicating what our rulers regard as virtue, and also terrorizing the public into reciting the required progressive shibboleths. This is why, inter alia, New York City's tolerance commissars would inflict fines of hundreds of thousands of dollars on employers who are made offenders for a pronoun because they have in some sense wounded the impossibly precious sensibilities of people who belong to a specially protected class. I don't know how you'd even define that class anymore. It's not enough to call it transgender. But somebody who was designated a member of that class is put into a position of using the state to punish those who have hurt his, her, or their feelings. Language breaks down and no longer serves as a medium of communication because it has to be mediated by people representing the ruling class. Now, Donald Trump has famously said that if he were elected president, people would say Merry Christmas again during the appropriate season. I don't know by what means he would fulfill that promise or any of the other things that he has promised the people who are gullible enough to support him. Under Barack Obama, and most likely under Hillary Clinton, the social atmosphere has been altered in such a way that it is all but compulsory for Americans to celebrate Gay Pride Month. You're seeing two contending visions of a civil religion, joined by the assumption that the chief magistrate, the president, is the pontiff of that civil religion. In the current issue of First Things, Sharif Girgis, who is a PhD candidate, offers a tremendously well-written and thoroughly terrifying analysis of the unfolding of the new progressive civil religion. For decades, writes Girgis, the sexual revolution was supposed to be about freedom. Today it is about coercion. Once it sought to free our sexual choices from restrictive laws and unwanted consequences. Now it seeks to free our sexual choices from other people's disapproval. That's a sharp turn, but it was inevitable. The ideals of the sexual revolution call for it. That is one lesson of the year that has passed since the Supreme Court imposed same-sex marriage in Obergefell versus Hodge. Most of Obergefell's lay supporters were simply moved by concern for our LGBT neighbors, a worthy and urgent concern that the church must be the first to heed, as Wesley Hill has beautifully reminded us in a previous essay published by First Things. But the court's ruling itself depended on a broader sexual progressivism, and its cultural fallout has made clearer that sexual progressivism is illiberal. Absorb its vision of the human person wholesale, and you will soon conclude that social justice requires getting others to subscribe to that vision, or to use Rousseau's categories, getting people to profess public fealty to the articles of the civil religion on the assumption that once their behavior or their speech deviates in any way from that profession of faith, they are to be punished by the state through means that include expropriation, banishment, and, if necessary, execution. And I don't use that in a productive sense, because here in the state of Idaho, one of the things that has been put into circulation is the idea that business owners who discriminate by refusing certain goods or services, for instance, for same-sex wedding ceremonies, are committing civic terrorism. That's become a truism here. How does the regime deal with terrorists? It deals with them using the disposition matrix. People who are suspected terrorists have their names inscribed on various lists, such as the no-fly list, which will be used, if Congress has its way next week, to justify the revocation of the right to keep and bear arms. That's probably the mildest prescription that we find here in the disposition matrix's treatment of suspected terrorists. If you are somebody who has the misfortune of not being a U.S. citizen, or if you are a U.S. citizen deemed to be an enemy combatant, the disposition matrix can authorize summary execution. That has happened to probably a dozen or more people who are U.S. citizens, including a 16-year-old whose only sin or crime was to be the son of somebody that the regime had identified as an enemy combatant, despite being a U.S. citizen who was fully invested with due process rights by any definition. Absorb its vision of the new sexual revolution, Gear just wrote, and you will soon conclude that social justice requires getting others to subscribe to that vision. In short, the ideas that Obergefell imposed on our government, I would say through our government, could hardly stop there, as with an evangelical creed, the legal system could not embrace them without feeling bound to spread them. Obergefell is thus best seen as a religious bull from our national magisterium, the Supreme Court, by the pen of its high priest, Justice Kennedy. With all the solemnity of a Chalcedon or Trent, it formalized new doctrines for our nation's civil religion, Gnostic ideas about the human person, ideas that, by their very nature, create an obligation to recruit new adherents, and ideas that, unlike true religion, could serve their purpose, whether or not they were accepted freely. Beyond marriage, continues the essay, this doctrine entails that sex doesn't matter, or that it matters only as an inner reality. Since I am not my body, I might have been born in the wrong one. Because the real me is internal, my sexual identity is just what I sense it to be. The same goes for other valuable aspects of my identity. My essence is what I say, and I feel that it is. The doctrine is also individualistic. I would say that it's actually solipsistic. On the old view, you could know important things about me unmediated. by knowing something about my body and our shared nature, and our interdependence as persons was as inescapable as our physical incompleteness and need, as male and female, infants and infirm. But if the real me lies within, only I know what I am. You have to take my word for it. I can learn nothing about myself from our communion. This isn't individualism, this is atomism. I'm reminded of Tocqueville's prediction about how America's individualism, as he perceived it, might give rise to a form of cultural totalitarianism, in which men, and presumably women, would be bound together no longer by principles, but by ideology, and we would become a kind of social dust that is scattered on every side, unable to collect and unable to cohere, unless we are pounded into bricks of conformity through the instrumentality of the state. A gender revolutionary solipsist can enlist the state to compel everyone around him, her, or jeer to participate in the solipsist delusion, and through the logic of the civil religion, we're being required to endorse those delusions, and then we face severe and potentially lethal punishment if we refuse to make that profession of faith or deviate from it. I'll be back in just a minute.
Replace them with our vision of the future. The party will lead us to the new age. There have been those who have tried to stop the new age. They are the corrupt reminder of the past. They have tried to confuse us with the idea that the old America was a good country. We know that lie. History teaches us that lie. We are grateful to our Soviet brothers who saved the world from destruction, and we can now join them in a world of socialist brotherhood. Everyone will go to school, everyone will have a job, everyone will be equal. No one will exploit or be exploited, and all those who oppose this wonderful vision will be crushed.
Hey! There's not gonna be any fight without Scott Riles and the incredibly polite Canadian news team.
Give me a break. They can't have news. Nothing happens in Canada.
We're gonna mop the floor with you. We're gonna put the boots to you. Sorry.
Sorry. We're gonna gouge your eyes out and kick your head in. Sorry!
Canada's reputation for preternatural politeness belies the fact that it has one of the most aggressively authoritarian governments in the Western Hemisphere. And a really good specimen of that authoritarianism is found in a recent ruling by the Ontario Superior Court of Justice in a civil case involving a student designated E.T. and that student's parents versus the Hamilton-Wentworth District School Board, as represented by the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario and the Attorney General of Ontario. That is to say, you've got one family versus the state government of Ontario, Canada. Ontario's public school system is constitutionally required to be open to all eligible pupils without distinction, begins the overview of the case. The Education Act, the Human Rights Code, and the Ministry of Education policy require school boards to promote a positive school climate that is inclusive and accepting of all pupils, regardless of race, ancestry, place of origin, color, ethnic origin, citizenship, creed, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, age, marital status, family status, or disability. The mandatory provincial curriculum is designed to reflect the diversity of Ontario society and to allow all students with their diverse backgrounds and experiences to see themselves reflected in the curriculum. The diversity that Ontario's public school system celebrates includes religious diversity, lies this ruling. School boards are expected to take appropriate steps to provide religious accommodations for students. Not all requests for religious accommodation, however, can be granted in a non-denominational public school system, which values the inclusion and acceptance of all students. Whatever their race, ancestry, place of origin, color, ethnic origin, citizenship, creed, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, age, marital status, family status, or disability. They might have missed a couple of categories. Unlike requests to exempt students from class at certain times or make modifications to their clothing to comply with their religious obligations, that I think would be a reference inter alia to the Sikhs, who have certain ceremonial accoutrements that they are allowed to wear. Requests to exempt students from the very portions of the curriculum that provide diversity, inclusivity, and acceptance cannot be granted without the risk of appearing to endorse the non-acceptance of students of other races, sexual orientations, family backgrounds, gender expressions, and gender identities. You're dealing here with an application of the civil religion. There's a profession of faith that is mandatory. You cannot be exempted from the obligation to make that profession of faith within the seminaries of collectivist conformity that are called public schools. Permitting students to be exempted from learning about diverse perspectives would impermissibly erode the public school system's ability to provide all students with a positive school climate free from racism, bullying, and discriminatory behavior, and to teach students how to help build a more inclusive and accepting society. They will be expected to help construct this new utopia on the basis of the civic theocratic mandates. Contrary to the applicant's submissions, it is not an infringement of religious freedom to be exposed to ideas and concepts that contradict your religious beliefs. Bear in mind, it's not mere exposure they're talking about, because in the previous paragraph, it is clearly stated that the purpose is to teach students how to help build a more inclusive and accepting society, a phrase which means, among other things, the forcible eradication of beliefs that this new theocracy would consider to be unacceptable regarding, among other things, sexual morality. As the Supreme Court has repeatedly held, learning that others do not necessarily agree with you and dealing with them in a respectful and accepting manner is part and parcel of life in a diverse and inclusive society such as Canada. The applicant remains free to teach his children his own religious beliefs at home. These are religious tenets. They are within the private sphere. He remains free to explain to his children why he disagrees with certain aspects of the public school curriculum. If he is unable to reconcile his religious beliefs with his children's participation in a non-denominational, diverse, and accepting public school system, he has the choice to homeschool his children or to enroll them in private religious schools. But having chosen to enroll his children in the public school system, it is not a reasonable accommodation to demand that his children be exempted from hearing the school's statutorily mandated message of acceptance and diversity. You have made a profession in the civil articles of faith. You are now required to abide by them. And as previously stated, your children will be expected to help build a new society that would be not only subversive of the values that you were imparting to them, but would be aggressively hostile to them. There is a lie. There's more than one lie, but there's one significant lie in what I just read out of this ruling. Namely, that if he were to teach his children at home, within the private sphere of his influence, he would not be molested by the state. This is an article from 5 years ago describing how Judge Nicole Bernier of Quebec, Canada, ordered 4 homeschooled children ages 9, 7, 5, and 3 into public school for socialization. The Roman Catholic family was reported to the Youth Protection Services of Canada for neglect, and after a 4-day trial in November 2010, Judge Bernier ordered that the children remain in school or daycare until a full plan for socialization was approved by the YPS. The Homeschooling Legal Defense Association of Canada had invested a significant amount of time and energy into this case. Following the outcome, Paul Ferris, president of the HSLDA of Canada, issued a statement which indicates, quote, "This is a shocking decision. Even more concerning is the judge's decision to order the younger children who are not of compulsory school age into daycare for socialization." A couple of years later, in Alberta, which is in Western Canada, and one would expect a little bit less inclined toward exotic forms of cultural Marxism, the government passed an Education Act under which homeschoolers and faith-based schools, these denominational sectarian schools that were referred to in this more recent decision out of Ontario, will not be permitted to teach that homosexual acts are sinful as part of their academic program, said the spokesperson for Education Minister Thomas Lukaszuk. Whatever the nature of schooling, homeschool, private school, Catholic school, we do not tolerate disrespect for differences. Donna McColl, Lukaszuk's assistant director of communications, told LifeSite News on February 23rd of 2012, "You can affirm the family's ideology in your family life. You just can't do it as part of your educational study and instruction," she added. Notice how they are constricting the ambit of privacy even further. Yes, within your own home, in your capacity as parents, you can express your religious views, but you can't do it if it's part of your homeschool curriculum. Reacting to the remarks, Paul Ferris of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association said the Ministry of Education is clearly signaling that they are in fact planning to violate the private conversations families have in their own homes. A government that seeks that sort of control over our personal lives should be feared and opposed, he added. No, a government that would do that needs to be overthrown. The HSLDA and other homeschooling groups warned this week that the new Alberta Education Act, which was retabled by Alison Redford's progressive conservative government on February 14th to replace the existing school act, threatens to mandate diversity education in all schools, including homeschools. Section 16 of the new legislation restates the current school act's requirement that schools reflect the diverse nature of Alberta in their curriculum, but it adds that they must also honor and respect the controversial Alberta Human Rights Act that has been used to target Christians and traditional beliefs on homosexuality. School is defined to include homeschoolers and private schools, in addition to publicly funded school boards. McColl emphasized that homeschoolers were already included in the current definition of school in the School Act going back to 1988 or longer, and Section 16, she said, is specifically with regards to programs, courses, and instructional materials. If you were a parent living in Canada, that immensely polite, genteel, soft totalitarian society, then you will be expected, if you take your kids out of public school, to indoctrinate them in the same tenets of their country's civil religion that are being imposed upon the inmates of its public school system. Ere long, that shall be the state of affairs here in the American Soyuz. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I will be back with you again in a week, and until then, as always, dum spiro pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and maybe send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.